Please be seated. Now the justices are a bit late, but they'll be coming in. We are continuing our hearing on 0709 in the matter of the definition of the practice of law and the administration of a rule defining the practice of law. And I have as our next speaker Mary Richards, American Family and Wisconsin Insurance Alliance.
Good afternoon, Justices.
Good afternoon.
I appear on behalf of American Family and the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance. I appear on behalf of a state industry that employs approximately 67,000 workers, Wisconsin industry of over 1,000 property and casualty and town mutuals, an industry that's paid approximately $172 million in insurance premium taxes to the state of Wisconsin in 2008.
How many lawyers does it have?
American Family?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you in our Wisconsin staff council offices, we have approximately 50. I believe the estimate was somewhere approximately 300 throughout the company.
Mm-hmm.
We now write in 19 states. I can give you additional information, but...
That's okay, too. I like it.
But it's not a commercial, and I can't...
We'll Google you.
I have been a licensed member of the Wisconsin State Bar since 1989, and I am currently employed as an in-house staff counsel attorney, and I represent American Family, insureds, customers, and the company in litigation. And I want to thank the court for allowing me to speak today. So why am I here testifying about UPL? Our position is that UPL is unnecessary, given that any abuses can already be addressed by the existing state statutes, Supreme Court rules, administrative rules, the administrative code, OIC, and common law. Enforcement and administrative mechanisms and processes are already in place, so we don't need to talk about additional funding and those types of things. And contrary to the state bar's work it out as we go proposal, we are already with our, we already have the mechanisms and processes in place to deal with this.
Counselor, are title insurance companies members of the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance?
I'm sorry, Madam Justice.
Are title insurance companies members of the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance?
I don't have that information currently. I can get that.
Thank you.
I've been informed that no, they are not.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So I am not speaking on behalf of title companies.
Thank you.
I also wanted to touch briefly on a point that was raised by the proponent of this petition this morning, that no attorney has voiced opposition to the funding of the proposal to foist UPL on OLR, and I would also note it doesn't seem that OLR is particularly eager to take up this gauntlet. But I understand this might not be a terrific sum of money that we're talking about, this add-on, but we're still in the embryonic stage of this proposal, and I would oppose any spending of any money by state bar members, particularly when we're only in the embryonic stages of this. We're talking about 15 to 25 cases, their best estimate. And we have no idea where this train is headed. If Wisconsin is determined to adopt the UPL rules, however, my industry wants us to get it right on behalf of Wisconsin Legal Services consumers. My industry is committed to service and protection of Wisconsin insurance. But the current proposal by the state bar fails to adequately do this, and its overbreath threatens the many Wisconsin attorneys that are employed by Wisconsin insurance companies. That's why if this court is going to act with regard to UPL, we need to have the insurance industry exception R to include subsections 7 and 8 that were proposed by the industry.
If I could just interrupt you. We have a letter from Peter Christensen, Counsel Christensen, and Andrew Franken, President of Wisconsin Insurance Alliance.
There, as I understand it, Madam Justice, there were many letters that were submitted?
I know, and I'm looking at this one because I am trying to make sure that what you're going to say does or doesn't fit this and whether we've got another position here too, okay? Are you familiar with the letter I'm talking about?
I'm familiar with the letters, yes.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, we're up to R.
I understand that the state bar has been working on and off trying to get UPL passed, but with such an important, difficult, and complex, and technologically evolving issue, if Wisconsin acts, we need to adopt a concise and unambiguous UPL policy. Despite the state bar's intentions to their best intentions or their desire to wrap this up and move on. It's our position that it's very unfortunate how the state bar has dealt with us in terms of trying to come to a consensus with regard to the insurance company exception. I would note that in the state bar's recent petition, or the recent submissions, they made reference to the input of the Indian Law section and the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups. And then with regard to the subsequent submission to the court that we submitted, it was should have been received by the court in October of 2008, there was no response back. There was no attempt to address our concerns. And instead, in the state bar's most recent filing, they simply state, quote, proposed changes which were not incorporated into the revised rule were not acceptable to the bar because in the bar's opinion, the purpose of the rule would not be furthered but hindered, end quote. So there was no substantive explanation as to why they wouldn't consider our concerns. There was no attempt to fix the defective proposal. I would also note that if the court is going to act, we need the insurance industry exception R to include sub 7 and 8, and I want to address a comment that was made by the Chief Justice that if regulated by other enforcement, why do we need to be included in the exception? You had touched on that briefly before the break, and I anticipated that's where this might go. Our industry has experienced that with overbroad UPL provisions, what follows is an attack on the insurance industry staff council operations. Where UPL goes, that's where the plaintiff's bar and the attacks on the corporate practice of law start in.
Well, you know, that issue about corporate lawyers came up in a number of different letters. I'm afraid I don't really understand it. Because if you're a corporate lawyer and you're licensed in Wisconsin, there's no issue, is there? So if you're not licensed in Wisconsin, we have rules about that now. You can give legal advice within the corporation without any problem. What's the problem?
It's a very hyper-technical argument.
Okay.
And I don't want to turn this into an ancillary proceeding about
right.
corporate practice of law
exactly.
issues, because we could go on for days about all of that.
Let's not.
I agree. It has to get into whether or not if you are technically employed by one particular corporate affiliate
right.
and you step beyond that relationship and you give advice to a different corporate affiliate that you are not directly employed by, that's the problem.
That's a very good, simple explanation. Thank you.
Thank you. The state bar has stated that its UPL purpose is to protect consumers hurt by people without proper training or oversight who attempt to practice law. And the state bar has pointed to complaints stemming from various family law matters, various real estate issues, estate planning, consumer debt, immigrant rights, notarios, unsupervised paralegals, etc. But nowhere in any of the petitions or in the supporting documents or in any of the weekly or monthly articles that have been published by the state bar advancing the UPL petition has the state bar cited to or provided any complaint related to an in-house or staff council operation.
I'm going to interrupt you once
yes,
again.
Ma'am.
We're looking at R, and that appears in the court tab. One. And on page A6 and A7, the court has both the industry exception proposed in March of 2008 and the bar's August 2008 submission. Now we're talking about sub 7.
Correct.
Sub 7 now says, or one of them says, that the following is not a practice of law. Using a lawyer employee or captive lawyer. That's if they have their own firm, but it's really the insurance company's firm.
Correct.
Admitted to the bar of Wisconsin, or we have licensed lawyer, or otherwise permitted to practice law in Wisconsin, that might be the corporate or pro hoc vici, to represent its principal, that's the employer, or corporate affiliate, or insured or non-insured for whom a defense is provided. You want that provision.
Yes, ma'am.
The bar struck it out.
Yes.
That's right. So that's what you're objecting to, right? Okay.
And they struck it out and haven't told us why.
Right.
Other than to simply say that with regard to, they have rejected R7 and R8, our number, the sub 8 is any act required of an insurer by law.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They want to substitute their own catch-all. And that gets us into a battle of what I call the catch-alls that I'll address.
Okay, their catch-all is provided that the Supreme Court has not determined. Is that the catch-all you're talking about?
Correct.
Provided that the Supreme Court has not determined by rule or opinion that the activity constitutes the unlicensed or unauthorized practice of law. Go ahead.
Okay. And they simply state that they reject our language and substitute their own, saying it's essential to preserve the right to act. And the problem is that the insurance industry needs the insurance lawyers in Wisconsin that are members of the state bar need the protection. Insurance in-house counselors, staff counsel, are an intensely educated and highly regulated breed of lawyer. We are regulated by the state bar, OLR, the insurance commissioner, et cetera. We receive specialized training in HIPAA compliance, Graham-Leach-Bliley Privacy Act, ethics, good faith, and fair dealing. And in-house counsels provide value for Wisconsin consumers. We focus our practice on specific type of cases, and we receive specialized training in those cases. We have the experience, skill, and efficiency in protecting our customers.
Counsel?
Yes.
If I may. I know that we, as a court, indicated, at least in our current working draft, which was posted on December 30th of 09, 7 and 8, as we've been referring to. Yet, if you would assist me, this is R in the exceptions and exclusions. The exceptions and exclusions in the proposed draft of the state bar indicates a license to practice law and active membership in the state bar of Wisconsin are not required for a person engaged in any of the following activities in Wisconsin. So that's the prefatory language for the exceptions. That's sub 2 that I'm reading from. Are you following me, or should I go over that again?
I am not following
okay.
What document you're referring to.
SCR, as proposed by the State Bar, SCR 2302 sub 2 has this laundry list of exceptions and exclusions, and R is one of them. So I read from the language of sub 2, which is entitled Exceptions and Exclusions.
Am I missing something?
No. Give her the punchline.
The punchline is, I don't understand
why you need 7.
Yeah, the punchline is exactly that. I don't understand the meaning of 7 when this isn't the practice of law, right? That's what sub 2 says. All of these A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way down to R and past. This is not the practice of law. So that's what we are enumerating under sub 2. And then you're saying sub 7 is not the practice of law. Using a lawyer employee or captive lawyer who's admitted to the bar in Wisconsin or otherwise permitted to practice law in Wisconsin. Okay, so now we've got a lawyer who's either admitted or under corporate practice. He can practice law in Wisconsin or she can practice law in Wisconsin. And when that lawyer, under your sub 7, represents
the company or the company's affiliate or an insured or non-insured for whom a defense is provided. You're saying that's not the practice of law? Boy, that surprises me. I would think that if I am an attorney licensed to practice law in Wisconsin and I am providing a defense for my for the company's insured, I'm practicing law. So help me with that. And let me just add to that. You're talking about someone who's licensed.
That's right. Who someone is licensed or is otherwise admitted to practice law in Wisconsin, and that they are, you know, a breathing live attorney, fully credentialed, and that they are representing someone, including an insured, and you're saying that shouldn't be considered the practice of law.
Who cares if it's the practice of law if they're licensed?
Yeah, that's the punchline.
That's the punchline. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that first. It's my understanding that one of the earlier drafts of this, the insurance industry exception, contained language that said, regardless of whether it is or isn't the practice of law,
yep,
we're making a specific exception for in-house attorneys. Okay, so that was the genesis of that. Then with respect to the statement, well, but they're licensed, so ipso facto, it is authorized practice. We're here asking that the specific exclusion be included so that there is no ambiguity as to the corporate practice of law attack and any other attacks that would be forthcoming. What has happened is that has been the experience of our industry, that when this exception is not included, the insurance industry exception is not included, what happens is we end up a few years later, after it's enacted, litigating in the courts.
I'll tell you, one of my concerns, I'm finding a little difficulty figuring out really why you need it. But above and beyond that, it's this. As I read it, it would say, I'm in-house counsel. I work in the litigation department for American Family. And I'm representing Mary Smith in Belmont, Wisconsin on her auto accident case. I'm providing a defense pursuant to the policy of insurance. And I take depositions, I file motions, I help with an investigation, all of that, this sub 7, as I read it, says it's not the practice of law. And I don't think that requires me to take much more of a leap than I would be willing to take. I look at the language. It says, using a lawyer employee, let's say I'm in-house counsel, and I'm licensed to practice law, and I represent an insured for whom defense is provided. Seems like that should be the practice of law to me. And if you say it's not the practice of law, and you really mess up and maybe do something unethical, then where do we go with that if they're not engaged in the practice of law in terms of lawyer discipline? So I've got some problems with the wording of that, and I have some problems for the so why you need it if they're already licensed to practice, why you say this, it's an exception, it isn't the practice of law. I mean, so, but even if you get over that first hurdle of why you need it, the wording causes me a problem. Are you following what I'm saying?
I'm following what you're saying because the way the rule is crafted, it speaks in double negatives. That's the problem with declaring what is the unauthorized practice of law versus dealing with the issue in terms of the converse, which is what is the authorized practice of law?
Well,
that's the problem.
Well, but it may be the problem of double negatives. When I get double negatives, I just say, okay, I'm going to make them a positive statement. But that's still, whether you look at it positively or negatively, I'm not in support of saying that when a house counsel or, does this cover retained counsel, outside counsel too? I don't know.
Captive
lawyer. I don't know if retained counsel or captives or not. I guess I'll have to ask them. when they're representing an insured, that's not the practice of law. I balk at that.
I think we're going to have to. If I hear you, your concern really is counsel representing internally the corporation and corporate counsel. And I just can't remember precisely what rules we adopted relatively recently about corporate counsel. And so I suggest we look at that and then see if it how it fits with this.
UPL, how they dovetail.
UPL. And I think, again, I'm not sure, but I think that in these materials there is a note to us that we have to do a cross-reference or some acknowledgement about house counsel and corporate counsel. So if that's your issue on 7, we'll have to look at that. But I agree with Justice Bradley in that what you have in 7 looks to me like a licensed Wisconsin lawyer practicing law, and if it's not practicing law, it doesn't matter because they're licensed. So we have to look at 7 carefully.
I understand. And the other note, or the other thing I would point out is that of the 23 out of 25 states that have addressed this issue of UPL, they have stated that staff counsel is not UPL. So we're just asking you to join what the majority of states that have addressed the issue have done.
And I think we just have to look at our corporate counsel section and then see if they have to be meshed or some change has to be made in this. But you're also objecting to the bar striking out 8.
Correct. The reason I'm objecting to the bar striking out 8 is it doesn't really say anything. It doesn't add anything new. It's just a catch-all that if the Supreme Court determines at a later date something has to be done, something needs to be done. Well, of course, everybody knows that. Everybody knows the Supreme Court has the ability to act when it needs to. So it doesn't give any guidance to the Wisconsin consumer. And what we're saying is our proposal 8, anything that needs to be done by an insurer, actually fleshes out additional rights for the Wisconsin consumer. And I'll give you an example. The state bar's proposal would put at risk an adjuster who wants to advise a customer regarding coverages under a particular portion of the policy. Where this usually occurs is in the first party coverages, a homeowner, a med expense coverage, UM, UIM, those kind of things. Under the current operating principles, we believe in the insurance industry that we have to provide consumers with coverage information. Yet the state bar's draft provides no mechanism for this good faith and fair dealing. It cripples the ability of us to deal openly and candidly with our customers.
You mean like the statute that requires you have to inform everybody, and I forget what it is, underinsured or uninsured motorist coverage is available.
And we
is that what
go,
you're talking about?
I'm talking about that. I could give you many more examples. I just wanted to hit one to show you that it's this gaping hole that if the courts want insurers, and insurers want to be candid and deal very openly and honestly with their customers, we need the protection that comes with 8.
You know, I can understand it in the examples you've given and in what I've given, but it does look like a very large area that's sort of unknown because we never know what the law is going to require. And that language is in another provision that we talked about this morning. I just can't find it now. But the same language of any act required of, it appears elsewhere.
And I do remember reading it at another time when I was reading the entirety of it.
Right.
Because I'm only here today for the insurance industry.
I understand that.
I forget
that.
Where else
But it appears somewhere else, unless otherwise required by a law.
I'd also like to address the state bar petition's rejection of the financial products exclusion or exception. The reality of the insurance industry is it's evolving and it's getting ever increasingly technical and complicated. Insurance itself is a financial product. Insurance falls under that penumbra of financial products and services. And The problem is we have gone so far beyond just the term versus whole life kind of distinctions that everyone used to commonly understand. Now with annuities, variable life policies, variable universal life policies, all these kind of things, the products themselves are getting so complicated that you can't just say this issue, this is a financial product issue. The labels, the terms, they are not that black and white. So that's why we're asking that the financial products language be put back into the insurance industry exception. I would also like
that's to... That's in the first couple of lines, as I understand it.
Correct.
All right.
And just for the record, I would also join in the submission, the 225-2010 letter submitted by the IIA and the PIA. And then finally...
What you'll have to tell me what all those stand for.
A lot of acronyms. Those are the agents, the letters that were recently...
The independent insurance agents, okay.
On DeWitt Ross Stevens.
Okay, you'll have to stand in front of the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yep, that's the one I think I made reference to before.
Okay. And then finally, I would also like to address exception Y. I think exception Y has sort of been forgotten about.
All right, let's just turn to that. We're at RSGUV. Non-lawyer or lawyer employees, is that the one you're talking about? That's V. That Y, maybe it's Y.
No, Y. Y is the exception, non-lawyer or lawyer employees or members of an entity or organization providing information or education about laws, regulations, legal procedures, and compliance issues for the purpose of training other employees or members of the entity or organization. The reason I want to bring that to the court's attention, that relates to any company, not just insurance companies, but any company that has an in-house training department or group that provides training about legal issues, compliance issues.
It could be a police officer training other police officers about search and seizure.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Could be a police officer training other police officers about search or seizure.
Could be. I mean, I'm used to more my context. My world is we have our training department come in and explain the meaning of various policy provisions, or else we might get training on the latest Medicare reporting requirements, Medicare, the HIPAA rules, all of that. Is without Y in place, that potentially renders our training employees engaged in unauthorized practice because they are providing advice.
Mm-hmm. What about Z?
I'd like to see it back in. Nothing in these rules shall affect the ability of a person or entity to provide information of a general nature about the law and legal procedures to members of the public.
Ooh. What about if Sam Smith got up on his stool outside the courthouse here and he decided to start explaining what he thought about tax law and when you don't have to pay taxes and when you do have to pay taxes? You think that might come underneath that provision?
I would submit that the easiest way around that problem is to reinstate the provision for the relationship, the attorney-client relationship requirement. That would heighten it.
Well, but you know what that does, in my view, is it lets you advertise in ways that will give very misleading advice just because there doesn't happen to be a current client-attorney relationship there. I mean, if we're trying to protect the consumer, we want to try to be as helpful as possible. And oftentimes, consumers are not yet in a position of an attorney-client relationship. What they're looking for is a little information to try to figure out, A, do they need a lawyer, and B, if they need one, who would be a good one to choose?
I don't disagree. I think you're on a slippery slope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of gray in all of this. And when we're trying to put forward a rule, a black and white rule that we all have to live with, we have to make sure that it's not ambiguous.
It's tough to do. I know everyone has worked very hard on this, but it's very difficult.
And I appreciate the work that's gone into it, but I think at this point we can't just ram this through because people are tired of talking about it. You know, if we enact it, we got to live with it. We got to fund it, but we also have to make sure that the ambiguities are taken out and removed. The other thing I would point out with regard to section, I asked that Y be reinstated. There is a note in the bar that, or in the discussion points of the, I'm looking at footnote 48 on page A9. It says the State Bar considers the provision unnecessary and would delete it. No party objected to this request. That's in the court's discussion papers. However, I noted that in the submissions by the State Bar took the position that it didn't regard it as necessary, but it wasn't opposing it. So I just wanted to correct the record with regard to exception Y.
Thank you, counsel. Anything else?
Chief,
Justice Bradley has a question.
No one has talked about Z thus far. Maybe we just haven't gotten that far to Z. But during the course of the presentations today, we discussed someone who can fill out the forms, and that's an exception. And now so legal forms, someone who can help prepare forms is not the unauthorized practice of law. Then you have Z. Now that person can also provide information of a general nature about the law and legal procedures to members of the public.
It's when you go to that next step of judgment, facts and circumstances. Here's the law, here's your particular set of circumstances. When you bridge that gap, then I would agree you've crossed the line into practicing law. Just providing information, I would disagree with that. It's what's done with the information.
That's an awfully fine line to draw, I think.
And
it's an awfully fine line to draw for regulation.
Exactly my point. So I just want to reiterate our continued support for the Wisconsin Legal Services consumers, and I thank the court for its time and attention.
Also, before you wrap it up, you've spent some time, a considerable amount of time, talking about the in-house counsel. Do you have any concerns about how any of the proposed rule might affect insurance agents or brokers or anybody else?
The reason for the insurance industry exception was to accept out the normal customary business practices and activities of the insurance industry. We have adjusters, and this has been my experience in at least one commercial carrier and now in a mutual fund. I know of all the other programs that I'm familiar with. All the other insurance companies have adjusters that adjust claims, investigate claims, and if it doesn't go into litigation, adjusters will compromise a claim, settle a claim, fill out settlements, releases, those kind of things. Those are normal activities that are done in the ordinary and customary work of the insurance industry. That's not practicing law. Again, we want that crafted out so that the agents and the adjusters, those people, are protected as well. But I would defer to the folks from the agents that are going to speak after I do.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you, Ms. Richards, for your help presentation. Michael Vaughn, Wisconsin Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Mr. Vaughn.
Thank you.
We had quite a number of letters from CPAs.
I'm delighted to hear that.
Chief Justice and members of the court, my name is Michael Vaughn, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Wisconsin Institute of CPAs.
And you submitted a letter on Murphy Desmond Stationery.
That's exactly
25
right.
February 2010.
That's okay. Correct.
Counsel, you may proceed.
You've been very gracious to hear from me several times over the near seven-year life of this proposal. I'll be very brief today. There's an elephant in the room, and that elephant is the economic self-interest of the people who have proposed this petition. If this were a bill in the legislature, it would be labeled a fence-me-in bill, and the people so labeling it would be right. This does not serve the public interest. It serves the private interests of those who propose it. For that reason, for the reasons I've laid out in the materials that I've submitted to you as of February 25th, and in all my previous submittals to you, we respectfully urge you to deny this petition. If you do choose to consider this petition, then we ask that you grant CPAs the exemption language that appear in paragraph S1 of the working draft. And at this point, I have to interject that there's a typographical error there that renders that language virtually meaningless. We had proposed, it appears on page 8 of your working draft, we had proposed that that language begin activities performed by.
Rather than proposed. We got
yes,
that. Right.
Not activities proposed by. And
thank you.
I've been in touch with staff, and they told me that you would be informed of, no, of
we,
that
we
correction.
Have been.
My reasons for requesting the exemption are also detailed in the current filing that I submitted to you on February 25th. I'd be very pleased to respond to any questions that you may have about this matter.
Counselor, go ahead.
The first sentence to me just says anything that a CPA does is okay. To me, frankly, that seems a little bit broad if we're trying to delineate the parameters of what are usual and customary for CPA
language. I disagree just a little bit.
Okay.
It says that the enforcement mechanism here, that halftime person or whomever, is not going to be coming after a CPA. But as I've explained in the material that I submitted to you on February 25th and earlier, there are several mechanisms for dealing with malpractice, if you will, by a CPA. So this isn't a boys' night out for CPAs.
You know, what I don't think that this proposal by the bar is aimed at CPA malpractice. I think it's aimed at trying to have the CPAs not do everything that lawyers do. I mean, that's the way I see it in kind of simple language. And when I read the first sentence, it says, this is an exception, so it falls outside the rule.
That's correct.
Activities performed by a certified public accountant or by a person working under the direction of a certified public accountant, period.
That's
to me,
correct.
That says if you're a CPA and you do it, it's okay. You're outside of this rule.
It says this rule.
Yeah. Well, and that's all we're dealing with today.
To you. And, yeah. And again, I would respectfully submit that there are all kinds of mechanisms at the federal level and at the state level, the accounting examining board being the most obvious, I suppose, for dealing with a CPA who does things he or she shouldn't do.
Yeah, no, I understand very much that's your position. I guess I don't see how the first sentence is any different than that. I think it's just a restatement of your position. I mean, you're making an exception for anything a CPA does.
That's correct.
And on the other hand, you're saying don't pass this rule because the CPAs are regulated enough. To me, I don't see the difference.
I'm saying don't pass this rule because I don't think any basis has been presented to you for passing the rule. If you do choose to consider it, then we are seeking an exemption.
Yeah, so anything.
That's correct.
Okay, I just wanted to be sure that I wasn't reading it too broadly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, the CPAs fall under O, don't they? Practicing within the scope of practice allowed by a current credential issued under 440 to 480.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I point out in the material that I submitted is that that doesn't apply because they don't have a credential issued under Chapters 440, et cetera, to out-of-state CPAs who may legally be in Wisconsin under so-called mobility laws. 49 states have now enacted these mobility laws, so there's considerable interstate movement back and forth. It wouldn't touch them.
Okay, that's why you want S. Now, and it also puts, it also protects your staff, the accountant's staff.
Correct.
And I have to go back and look at O and see if it might be protected under O, too, depending on how you read that. The dispute may arise as to whether whoever is going to enforce this, the director of the OLR or whoever, shall forward a complaint to the accounting examining board. And the I think the bar wanted May. Do I have that right?
Well, the bar wasn't that's paragraph S. The bar wasn't happy with that. It's paragraph S1 that
right,
which is a more all-encompassing exemption that we had proposed.
Yes, but yes. That says shall. So it
yes.
takes it out of the administrator and puts it into the department. You want that because you don't want to be regulated by two different people,
We think that that's the appropriate place for it with that department, which is the one that oversees
right.
CPAs. And if a CPA is doing something wrong, they should be getting at it.
I understand the bar is saying, well, the administrator should be able to do something with it, doesn't have to send it to the department. That's the dispute, right?
Well, that appears to be what they say. We may be back to that elephant in the room that I suggested earlier.
I wish you'd pick a different animal because we're nonpartisan.
How about 800-pound gorilla? I was just seeking to use fewer syllables, but we'll change my remarks to that if we may.
I'm much more comfortable.
All right.
Thank you. Mr. Vaughan, Justice Bradley, Justice Prosser.
Are any CPAs lawyers?
Some are, certainly. There's a member of my firm, is at least one, is both a CPA and a lawyer.
And so lawyers can be CPAs?
Yes.
What happens if there's a complaint against a lawyer who is also a CPA? Should that be referred to the county examining board?
I would assume that it would depend on the nature of the objection, complaint rather. If the complaint is about the lawyer for lawyering, then that would proceed in the manner it would proceed against any other lawyer.
How do you, well, first of all, does S say that?
Well, it's S1 that is the language that I had hoped you would consider. It does not say that precisely. I'm not sure that language can be written to cover both aspects of this two-headed lawyer CPA, but I don't believe that language would prevent going against the lawyer as a lawyer.
The director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation shall forward any complaint received against a certified public accountant.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I were a lawyer who was a certified public accountant, I would say, I want to get rid of OLR. I want to send this over to the accounting examining board.
I suspect that I'd say that too if I were a lawyer CPA who has had a complaint brought against me. I choose to believe that the OLR would say, fella, we're proceeding against you as a lawyer, not against you as a CPA, and therefore we will retain jurisdiction.
Well, you know, Mr. Vaughn, how devoted I am to plain language. Doesn't the plain language say that this ought to be referred to the accounting examining board?
I don't think it does. I think that it says if the complaint is brought against this person as a CPA, then it needs to be referred.
Where would a trust account violation go?
I'm sorry.
Where would a trust account violation go by a certified public accountant attorney?
I assume that that would be against him as a lawyer, but that's you make a very good point, and perhaps we need to clarify, if you choose to consider this further, that in the case where someone has dual credentials, that you can proceed against the lawyer if it's lawyering that is being objected to.
So your position would be we wouldn't have to fix this if we just stopped and didn't do anything. Is that right?
If you were to reject this rule, that's exactly right. And
so to go forward, we have to fix this. Is that right?
If you choose to do so, yes.
This S is under that it's not the practice of law. The CPA's ordinary activities as a CPA is not the practice of law. That's the point of this, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. The point is to prevent an overzealous employee from looking around for something to do and in the process improperly hassling a CPA who is behaving like a CPA.
But that begs the question, is a CPA behaving like a CPA engaging in the practice of law?
Well, there is, of course, a considerable overlap between what CPAs do and what lawyers do. And I touch on that in the material that I submitted to you. And I say we end up with a chicken and egg argument, in which CPA or whomever a complaint is brought against says, I'm just doing what I do within the scope of my practice. And the complainer says, no, you're not.
I don't know what the jurisdiction of the accounting examining board is. I just haven't refreshed my recollection or gone to look at the jurisdiction. If a comparable entity is the Office of Lawyer Regulation, that doesn't deal necessarily with malpractice, but rather ethical violations. Mm-hmm. Does the accounting examining board deal with malpractice allegations, or is it primarily like our OLR, which is to deal with ethical lapses?
I would say that it's both. It is authorized to take up, and excuse me, I'm going to have to give you a citation that I'll have to look up. Accountancy 1.201 is the rule that I would mention mm-hmm. here. And it says that, in essence, a CPA is supposed to only do things that CPAs are authorized to do and to do them properly.
Yes,
so it's both ethics and a factual question of whether a CPA can do things or not would be within the scope of the accounting examining board review.
It seems to me rather circuitous
because if the inquiry is they can do anything that they're allowed to do, and this S says they're allowed to do anything they do, that's awfully circuitous to me.
I'll just mention again.
I just see that circle.
They aren't allowed to do anything they choose to do under Accountancy 1.201. So there is a full body of regulatory control that applies to prevent CPAs from behaving improperly.
Can you give me an example? And perhaps you're not able to, and that's fine, of what 1.201 authorizes them, or rather prohibits them from doing?
It prohibits them from doing things beyond the scope of what a CPA is authorized to do.
Can a CPA do estate planning?
In some instances, I believe the answer may be yes. Certainly, the tax consequences of putting an estate plan together are things that CPAs work with clients on all the time.
Can a CPA draft a trust?
I don't believe so, but I'd have to check on that. I'd be glad to get back to you if you like.
I can check on it too. Thank you. That's fine.
Mr. Vaughn, this might be a silly question, but it keeps going through my mind. With all these different groups who come up here who have their own licenses they have to get and they have their own authorities that they have to report to, do you have rules that define what's a CPA? I mean, what if someone's practicing accounting as a CPA and they don't have the right to be doing that? Does your group go after those people? Is that what other groups do? Because there must be requirements, and you have to be licensed to do them. So if you are licensed, what do you do with the people who are interfering with your area of practice or saying that they can do what you do, but they can't? I'm trying to figure this out. I mean, are we embarking on new ground saying this is lawyering, and nobody else can do it, but we get to act as accountants, we get to act as realtors, we get to act. I'm just trying to figure out how it works from the opposite angle.
I think you're asking me if someone may do what it is that only a CPA is supposed to be able to do without being a licensed CPA. Is that
right? What do you do? What do you do with that person who's saying, I can do all your tax work just like a CPA, just as good, save you some money. Well, let me fill your forms out.
There are a couple of ways to get at that. One would be that the accounting examining board, again, through its body of regulations and the statutes for that matter, should go after that person. Another, and we haven't really talked about this today, I don't think, another is that civil law should be available. If Justice Prosser,
highly suspect,
forgive me, does something that he shouldn't, that CPA stuff, he can be sued for that. After all,
if he messes it up, right?
But even if he doesn't mess it up, the accounting examining board may say, "You're doing a wonderful job, Justice Prosser." That's called sucking up in some circles. Forgive me. but you're not a CPA,
right,
and therefore you mustn't do it, and they could bring an action to enjoin him from doing it for violation of the rules and statutes.
Isn't that what this is all about?
I think this is exactly what this is all about. And the question is, should this new, very broad net be cast upon these waters where considerable regulation already exists? We've heard so much about, this morning, the 200 examples over the last decade, if I recall. But when the bar presented its revised petition to you the last time, after you told them to go away and come back with bad examples, they presented 37 objections, 29 of which were from attorneys. I'm not sure that the broad base of improper behavior, people pretending to be lawyers, is demonstrated by the statistics that have been brought to you.
Mr. Vaughn, I believe it was 200 over the last 20 years.
Okay, fine. I accept the correction and apologize.
Mr. Vaughn, can a non-CPA accountant do everything that a CPA does? Just can't hold himself out as a CPA? No,
he cannot. Again, that's because of both the statutes and the rules.
Provide CPAs can, only CPAs can do A, B, C.
Yes.
Well, if only CPAs can do A, B, C, what's the matter with a rule that says only lawyers can do X, Y, Z?
Well, one of the problems is that CPAs may also be empowered to do X, and in some cases, maybe they can do some of Y as well. And that's why.
And that's the overlap.
Mm-hmm. XYZ mm-hmm. is too broad, we believe.
Thank you.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions for Mr. Vaughn? Hearing none, Mr. Vaughn, I want to
thank you very
you
much
for your appearance today, and as I have said before, for all your work and the others in prior hearings. We go to Gary Peterson, President, Wisconsin Chapter of American Planning Association.
If it will please the court, I am Gary Peterson. I'm a member of the American Institute of Certified Planners. I'm also president of the Wisconsin Chapter of the American Planning Association. We have one item under the exemptions. It's item N.
Item what?
N.
N. N. Got
N it. An governmental agencies and their employees carrying out responsibilities provided by the law. If employees would include contractors and subcontractors other than our or just people earning wages, we don't have an issue. But if employees means that you are on the payroll of a governmental agency, then we would want to see that exemption expanded and use contractors and or consultants or both, so it read governmental agencies and their contractors, their consultants, and their employees carrying out responsibilities provided by law. Our main issue would be with zoning ordinance, subdivision regulations, official maps. Most of those are written by consultants, not by employees of the governmental agency. Right now, the city of Madison is spending over $300,000 on consultants to revise the city zoning ordinance. So if we can get those exemptions included, we're cool with the law.
But don't you do work also for private people who
right,
want to subdivide, et cetera?
No. Those would be not a legal document. They would be the document that turns into a legal document.
Yeah, but you would be advising the owners
or planners or developers about what was required under the law. You got to put X number of streets, Y number of driveways.
That's true. 236 statute. Oh. They would, yes.
Do you want that excluded from this law?
I'm not a lawyer, so yes, thank you.
It's because N deals with people who work for the government, mm-hmm. either full-time employees or contractors. So you come in here to talk about contractors and consultants, but we did have, and I'll just have to look at this again, when we examined this draft or a previous draft before, a number of professions and careers came in and said, hey, we interpret the law for our clients. So a surveyor, planner, interpreted the law in doing their business. And I don't know if there's a provision here that deals with or includes that, but I'll think about that.
Okay. I'm dealing with the August 4th draft 3,
right.
If you
mm-hmm.
had something yep. after that.
I know, and you're dealing with N.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's true. I'd just make one additional comment. If these rules would prevent the unauthorized legal advice to immigrants, basically keep immigrants from being ripped off, we would really support that because we deal with the same populations in housing and transportation and jobs, and we do not want to see them get ripped off. We would appreciate the rule.
Have you perceived a problem in that population?
I personally have not, no, but it certainly could be because we're dealing with people that many times don't know the language and they're just really out and about, but getting citizenship we know is so extremely important to them that they will do a lot of things that maybe we would question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, did you submit something?
No, I did not.
So, once again, the words that you would like to have added to N are what?
Be government agencies, their contractors, consultants, and employees carrying out responsibilities provided by law.
Got it.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Mr. David, where are we?
Please the court. My name is David Werwey. I'm a member of the State Bar, a member of its Professionalism Committee, a resident of Wisconsin, and a licensed insurance agent in the state of Wisconsin. I don't currently practice as an insurance agent, but I keep the license up and do the continuing education. I don't represent any of those organizations today. I'm just here as a lawyer, and we haven't had any lawyers that today anyway have really come forward and spoken strictly against it other than American Family. And I wanted to address some of the conversation that's taken place this afternoon. Chief Justice, you asked the gentleman from the CPAs to address him formally. What's wrong with a rule saying a lawyer can't do X, Y, and Z? Well, we don't have that situation before the court. What we have is a proposed rule that says this is what people can't do to infringe on lawyers. So it's a little bit different. And Justice Bradley had asked the question of American Family and the Insurance Alliance about paragraph R, and I think the Chief Justice sort of inquired about what when you have a licensed lawyer in Wisconsin representing a policyholder, why is that even an issue? Why is that somehow the unauthorized practice of law? And I think, to be quite honest with what the justices were doing, we're actually giving the argument that the insurance industry advances when they come across the argument that they're somehow practicing law without a license. And I think the reason maybe the court was doing that in this case was because that's generally what's been accepted in Wisconsin, and that's just something we don't think twice about. But in other states, and I think, and you know, I can't testify that this is specific, but I think Texas recently had some challenges to the insurance industry and their use of in-house counsel. And the argument, I believe, went because an insurance company controls certain rights to control the litigation within the policy, such as to settle the case or go to trial, that's the corporation practicing law. And in the in-house context, American Family, for example, can't go to the UW and get a law license. They can't get a judicial degree and they can't get a law license. So therefore, it becomes the corporation practicing law without a license because they're making what could be called a legal decision. And so that's where we get into the argument that that's a corporation practicing law without a license. So why do we need R? Well, if we look at Section 2, which goes back to the rule basically says if you have a license in Wisconsin to practice law, you can practice law. Then the exceptions are, specifically R, doesn't say, well, persons doing this. It says entities or businesses. So it's no longer the person that we've talked about when we say a person can have a law license. We do need to create the exception for the insurance industry for when we have the argument that, well, you're just a corporation practicing law when you use your captive lawyer. So that's why I think that R has been interjected by the insurance industry. When you also consider R, one could make the argument, well, R also talks about employees. Well, isn't a captive lawyer an employee? But if you look at R without the 7 and 8 that talks about captive law firms, it says employees conducting maybe their customary insurance business. Well, then I suppose that's some ambiguity as to whether a captive lawyer within the company when they're representing policyholder, is that the business, the insurance indemnity, is that their customary business? Well, maybe it is. But as somebody who has practiced as an in-house counsel for an insurance company that's represented policyholders, I'd like to not have my job questioned and say, no, what you do is illegal, essentially. And so I like 7 and 8 in there because it specifically addresses me. And I want my state bar, who says they're not coming to attack my position, to say, fine, we're not attacking your position. You can have your exemption and you don't have to worry about it. Similarly, with the R, you know, the state bar did come in and say, well, we want R1. And so they do acknowledge that there was at least a problem with not having R. And I think if you look at that, what the state bar's R does is talks about claim representatives who, for instance, when there's no liability defense, let's say a dog jumps up and scratches somebody on the arm and they say, gee, I got this scar on my forearm from that dog. You know, give me $500 and I'll sign a release. And, you know, maybe the insurance company then has the adjuster do that. And I think under Wisconsin law that's something that is currently done and can be done. And I think that's why the exception proposed by the state bar for
that's a form, a form release.
I think it probably is drafted by lawyers and something that's just a form. And then the third difference between R and R1 that I saw was about financial products. And I think that's important from my background as an insurance agent. I don't practice as an insurance agent, but someday I might. And I'd like to be able to practice well and recommend to my clients variable products if I got a securities license and was able to sell it under Wisconsin law and federal law. And those types of financial products that go beyond just what's chartered by a federal bank or a state bank. So I think in order for that type of typically accepted practice that currently exists in Wisconsin to not have that attack on insurance agents, I think you need to keep that financial product language in there as well. Getting away from insurance for just a second, Z was brought up, that paragraph Z. And Z, I think American Family might have finally touched on it near the end, but it gets a little echoey in here at times, and I don't know that I heard exactly right. But an example came to mind, I think it was 10 years ago when I was at the law school here in Madison. They had the Legal Information Center, and it was somewhere near St. Paul's Church down in the basement. And somebody, a member of the public, would call in, and they'd call the law school maybe and say, hey, you know, this is happening to me. Do you have somebody that can help me? And they'd often refer it to the students down in the Legal Information Center. And what was important about the Legal Information Center is they didn't practice law. I mean, they're students. They can't. But they can give information. And that's the difference. It's when somebody says, hey, my landlord wants to evict me, but I don't think they've done everything right. What can I do? Well, then that law student might say, okay, well, let's go to the administrative code and find out what the obligations are of landlords. Let's go to the ordinances, and here are those provisions. You may have a right to small claims court. You should consult the lawyer. There may be things like that. But where it crosses the line into advice is when, as the justice said, could somebody have a school outside that said, you know, this is when I think you have to pay taxes and this is when I think you don't have to pay taxes. When you cross the line to advice, that's no longer legal information. Legal information is responding with fact, what can I do, not what should I do, and then having somebody give an opinion. And I think that Z is necessary for law students or those types of people who are just providing legal information and not crossing the line into that advice category. One thing that I notice as we sit here, I think the reason that we have been toiling over all of this is I'm not sure that this conversation is taking place in the right wing of the Capitol. This all seems to me to be a legislative function, that this is more appropriately addressed for the legislature. The State Bar came in today and said you were going to hear from interest groups and why they oppose the rule. Well, the largest represented interest group in this conversation is the State Bar. And yet, we don't have the public outcry as to why the public needs to be protected. Really, what this does is protect the lawyers. Lawyers who...
Protects you.
It is me. Lawyers who may not advertise the value of their services sufficiently. Lawyers that may not provide enough pro bono services. Lawyers who price themselves out of the market and create the opportunity for these other people to pop up. But when you do have members of the public affected, that's where the legislature should step in and protect the public, not the lawyers. And the lawyers admit this isn't something that's supposed to protect the public. That's why the lawyers are footing the bill. $10 for every lawyer is going to pay for this, not any of the taxpayers. So you look, okay, what has the legislature done to address this? Well, 75730 is right there. And the criminal DAs, well, they may not be picking it up, but that's a complaint for the DAs, or that's a complaint to go back to the legislature and say they need more funding to do this. If there was that public outcry, the public would be concerned enough to go to the legislature and there'd be action. Because there's not, I think it's not a difficult conclusion to draw that maybe there isn't this outcry and this ever present need that's been alleged. The statute itself is not useless as it was characterized. I think it's broad enough to encompass some of the things that they're trying to prevent, yet it allows for the court to kind of develop the definition through the common law, which is perfectly appropriate.
Counsel, do I understand you to just oppose the entire proposal?
I do, you know, and...
Okay. And if we did it, you want R in.
And I think Z as well.
Z.
Yes.
Okay.
And, you know, just title insurance was also brought up. That's the officer of the insurance commission, Office of the Insurance Commissioner. They regulate the title insurance. They regulate insurance agents. There's another body that can go after those people. If a lawyer's problem with a title insurance company exists, then that lawyer should be complaining to the OIC, and then there'd be an investigation. Maybe there'd be a consent decree. There's a procedure in place already. We don't need another one. As a member of the Professionalism Committee of the State Bar, I can tell you that as much as we strive to do excellent work, and we do a lot of it, when that budget comes around and says, okay, well, we've got to vote for a new budget, I always see that number higher than it was the year before, even if we didn't spend what we spent the year before. It's not going to be any different when we start out with a half-timer. The half-timer is going to become a full-timer. Then the full-timer is going to say, well, the reason I'm not effective isn't because there's only 5 or 10 complaints coming in. It's because I just can't investigate them all. I need more people. I need more money. And then it's not just $10 a year per lawyer. It's $100 or $150 a lawyer. And I'm also licensed in Minnesota. We pay almost $400 a year. So then it may be the argument is, well, look, Minnesota pays $400. We're only asking to pay $300. Even though that's double what you used to pay, it's still not what other states are charging. So I see a snowball effect. I don't see that this is going to be an efficient administrative system, as they call it.
Thank you, Mr. Waring. Are there any questions?
Were you done, Mr. Waring?
Yes or no? Yeah, I think everything else that I was going to add has been talked about, or just, you know, some little things that I was wondering about as we look through this. Who puts a check on this half-timer?
Who what?
Did the what?
A check. You know, the legislature's checks and balances, we have that with the judiciary. Who puts a check on this half-timer? What happens if the half-timer goes after somebody and loses and faces a lawsuit for damages or business interference or interruption or slander? What happens with that? The lawyers get stuck with the bill there? I think there's a lot of unanswered questions because the state bar is asking the court to kind of venture into new territory here and create this body that's probably more appropriately created in the legislature, not here. The legislature's already spoken on that issue with 75, 757-30, and I think it's more appropriate to leave it there.
Thank you, counsel. Stephen Heil.
And please, the court, I believe that you do have a letter that I sent previously about it.
Are you appearing for or against this bill?
I'm appearing, according to my letter, I was appearing in favor of it with some specific
objection. You changed your mind?
Objection. You know, to be honest with you, justices, after listening to the speakers who have given so much information this afternoon, it strikes me as that there is an animal in this room, whatever animal you want to call it, and that is the allegation that, or the insinuation that lawyers are simply trying to protect their turf, that this is simply an economic issue and therefore it should be denied for that reason. I would submit to you that I think my position in this as an attorney, young, relatively young attorney, or at least I was 10 years ago when I started, that there needs to be some more effective administration of unauthorized practice of law precisely to protect the economic issues of lawyers. And I say that because I spent anywhere between $60,000 and $70,000 on law school. I spent my time. I'm not ashamed to admit I sat for the bar exam in this state three times, pulled my hair out, and struggled to become a lawyer in this state precisely to uphold what I believed was a fundamental tenet of society, which was the rule of law. And I don't want to get too philosophical in this, but I think that what we have heard today is simply a parade of various professions coming in and justifying their turf, but accusing lawyers of doing the same thing. And that strikes me as a little bit disingenuous. Now, ironically, I would ask the court to deny the petition as it's drafted, in spite of what I've just said. And I say that because I think there's just a fundamental problem with the structure of the proposed rule. And that fundamental problem is you set out to say no one except an attorney, somebody who's gone to law school, spent all the money, sat for the bar exam, did all this, can practice law except, and now we have such a laundry list of exceptions, including the catch-all of, well, anybody can just fill in a form. It essentially guts the rule and makes it meaningless. And I would agree that to have an administrative body or an agency funded to try and enforce this thing, I think would be a waste of money. But I'm not hopeless that a rule couldn't be crafted. But it would have to be a rule that respected the contribution that lawyers make to the orderly administration of our society. Now, as I listened to the various professions come in and set out what they fear that they will no longer be able to do to earn money, I can respect that because I am myself in business to make money so that I can feed my four kids and my family and make a living just like anyone else. In my own general small-town practice for about 10 years. Coincidentally, drive past the sign in tab 2 there on a week, nearly a daily basis, so have some personal experience with that. You know, I can say that My own experience is that I find myself collaborating with CPAs. I find myself collaborating with realtors. I find myself collaborating with financial planners more than I do fighting them for their business. Where the harm that I see, the need for some regulation comes in, is to go back to your tab 2, the sign. And I think it gets to this. I'm not going to go too much into this because I explained it in my letter, but I think it goes to a sort of devaluation of law that is created by a fill-in-the-form mentality. When you have a paralegal who does not have an attorney supervising his or her work, advertising that I will file your divorce for you, but I'm just helping you fill out the forms. Well, what does that entail? Let's think about it. Tails, let's print out the forms. What forms do we need? I paid for a course in civil procedure. I was taught this is how you bring an action, this is how you do this. Even the selection of forms itself is practicing law. And as lawyers, we ought not apologize for that. There's more than one way to skin a cat in many cases. And so the selection of the procedure makes a difference. Is this the right time for a person to be getting a divorce? If they get a divorce now with their property values devalued because of the economy, are they going to suffer consequences down the road? Certainly, other professionals can have the knowledge to fill in a quitclaim deed. It doesn't take a whole lot of technical knowledge to figure out, well, who are the buyer, who's the seller, what's the legal description, and they may do that very well. But they're doing it in a vacuum. They're doing it within the context of one specific transaction. They're not necessarily thinking about consequences down the road, the impact of marital property on that transaction. Getting to the example of the divorce, going through the petition. If the paralegal is sitting there saying, okay, we got to fill this out, we get to the box where it checks, does the person want maintenance or not? I find it absolutely incredible, and I refuse to believe that any consumer in that situation is not going to ask the question, well, what does that mean? Am I entitled to maintenance? Should I bring it or not? Should I check this box? And I refuse to believe that this paralegal is going to sit there and say nothing, even if the service provider reaches behind him or herself onto a shelf and grabs a book, Law of Maintenance in Wisconsin. There's a representation being made there that the information is accurate, that the information is current, that the information has not been overturned by the Court of Appeals, by the Supreme Court. All of those aspects have, for many, many years, been the domain of lawyers, and I don't think we need to apologize for that. I think the largest animal sitting in the room is that the legislature itself, in enacting a criminal statute, has spoken and said the unauthorized practice of law is illegal. Why? Because the people recognize that the practice of law is inherently valuable. So I would ask the court to table this question. I think that exploration of a rule is certainly a worthwhile exercise. I do believe that relying on the criminal statute to resolve the problem will not work. And I think the reason for that is simply this. If I'm a district attorney in a small town, who are the violators of 757? Well, it's the persons that the head of the PTA, the Cub Scout leader. These are all respected professionals within the community. Is it appropriate to pursue that in a criminal context? I don't think it is. I don't think that there's a level of culpability there that warrants making criminals of people for this. I think it's more a question of just coming up with a definition that is sufficiently delineates what is the practice of law, regardless of whether or not other professions may be stepping on that right now. And that definition then adds the two purposes. One is, if a oversight agency or board is created, they have a definition to work with, but also within the context of individual lawsuits or individual petitions for injunctive relief, there's some place for a circuit court judge to look to define, to make that determination. Is this something that needs to be prescribed or not?
Well, do you like a petition if it just had 23.01 defining law, practice of law, and not had 23.01.02, the exceptions?
I think as a practical matter, there would have to be a few exceptions, but I think the number of exceptions would be extremely small.
Which ones do you like?
I have no objection to the concept of even individual professions identifying what it is that they're trying to protect. But I do have an objection to individual professions coming in saying, well, I don't only want to protect what we're doing, but I want to prevent anyone from prescribing something I might want to get into the future. So I think that it would not be impossible to explore and look at what would, for example, in the context of CPAs, what activities are there? Preparation of tax returns, doing the books, accounting, whatever it is they do. I was an English major, so I'm not even going to delve into their expertise. That's why I use them as consultants. I think that you could identify what those areas are. The legislature's already spoken and said if you're doing something outside of that and it's traditionally the practice of law, that's wrong. So I think that it's possible to find that line.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Counselor.
Give me your name once
Justice
more.
Prosser.
Your name once more is? Steve
my name Heil. Is Jody Stephen Heil. I go by my middle initial.
H-E-I-L. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom Cullen.
My name is Tom Cullen. I'm an attorney licensed to practice law in the state of Wisconsin. I'm a title guy. I work for a title insurance company. I work for Attorney's Title Guarantee Fund. We are a unique title company insofar that our title insurance is exclusively produced by attorneys. And the reason why our business model is based on that is because the concept is that transferring of title is a legal function. That's a legal function. So that's a lawyer's role to make sure that the buyer is getting the start with the seller. The seller is transferring title to a buyer and is done in a proper manner. That's not the role of a title insurance company. That's not the role of a realtor. And quite frankly, what has happened over the course of the years, that role, that function of transferring title, that lawyer function has been squeezed out. The lawyers we have over 200 plus agents throughout the state of Wisconsin. And I frequently get lawyers like Greg Gutorso, who's one of our agents, complain that the title companies, the realtors are stepping into the area of practicing law. Now, how do you regulate that? I don't. I mean, the rule here today needs to be redrafted. I'm not a particular fan of this particular rule. I am not a fan of this particular rule. I think there's way too many exceptions. I think it'd be very hard to analyze. It'd be very hard to make a determination as to whether or not a particular individual falls under a particular exception. But the general concept here is that lawyers don't have an avenue at this time to protect the consumer, because it's the consumer in the end that's being harmed. We keep hearing there's no harm. In the real estate context, the consumer doesn't even realize they're being harmed, because what's going on here is that a title commitment's being produced. That title commitment is raising exceptions on and not providing insurance, not providing protection to the buyer.
I just want to ask you a question.
Who provides the title insurance? Now, title insurance is a printed form, then it has except as good warranty merchantable title, except as follows, colon. Who puts in those exceptions? Is it a lawyer?
In our context, in our company, it's a lawyer. We have lawyers that, you know, they have staff, but the ultimate responsibility, the underwriting decision. Is the responsibility of the lawyer. Now, that's not true industry-wide, and I'm not advocating that that has to be done in that.
That's what I'm asking you.
Right. No.
So you have someone who's very experienced in examining title, and they put in the exceptions, and it needn't be a lawyer.
Correct.
Okay.
But that's not protecting the buyer. Because what that title insurance product does says that we're accepting everything all out. The buyer doesn't understand what they're getting and what they're not getting, and the role of the lawyer is to help them resolve those title issues. There may be exceptions on there that, let's take it from the seller's perspective, that they're providing merchantable title, and they're not, either it's being accepted out on the insurance policy. That seller may be on the hook for that.
Or the buyer may be on the hook because the title insurance does not guarantee that this is a buildable lot.
Correct. And I'm not saying that, you know, there has to be a lawyer in every transaction. That's up to the consumer to decide.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. It's up to the consumer to decide. The consumer says, I can get a lawyer to come with me and read this title policy, or I can read the title policy.
Correct. And it has
a perfect right to represent himself, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So he says, I'm going in and I'm not having a lawyer. I'm representing myself. Reads the title policy and says, swell with me.
Right. I have no problem with that.
The problem comes in
is where the title company, the title insurance, the closing agent,
or
the realtor,
says
you don't need to worry about that document. And the buyer and seller, what are they looking for? They're just trying to get this deal done. The buyer wants the keys. The seller wants the money. 99% of the time, it's not a problem.
All right. So should we have something in here that says no one is allowed to tell anyone else, you don't need a lawyer.
And there is rules in place like that for realtors.
Right.
So we
don't have to duplicate that. What about rules for title insurance?
I think that's an excellent idea. There was also a suggestion that the OCI would step in. That's the protection method.
Yeah.
I've had experiences with this. We've gone to the OCI on this issue, and they're saying that's a state bar issue. That's a law license issue. Or that's what the state statute says. That's a DA's issue. That's not, you know, if it's a title insurance issue, it has to do with respect to the issuance of title insurance.
So what have you said to the OCI? That's the Officer of Commissioner of Insurance,
correct.
I assume. Okay, what do you say to OCI?
OCI said follow the statute.
No, I mean, what did you complain about that you wanted them to do something about?
These are through our agents. The complaints that, and I shouldn't say these are all secondhand complaints, but the complaint were that I was involved with, it ended up being a title claim, but the closing agent told the consumer that you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to worry about these exceptions. And one blew up in that person's face, and they wanted to complain. And essentially, the OCI took the position that this really isn't technically a title insurance issue. It really is really more of a closing issue, which is a separate and distinct part of the title insurance practice. That's not really regulated by OCI.
Is there an association of title insurance companies?
Yes, I am on the board of directors of the Wisconsin Land Title Association.
So do they have a code of ethics?
We do not have a code of ethics.
Ah, there's a job for you, right?
I bought myself a job.
And then the code of ethics could provide, thou shalt not tell them not to get a lawyer.
And that's fine.
Thou shalt not give legal advice.
And I think that's an excellent first step, but...
I certainly can
bring it up to our board of directors at our next meeting. In fact, we're having our teleconference meeting for the board on Thursday, and I will bring that up. I mentioned that Justice Aberson suggested that we should develop a code of ethics similar to like the realtors have.
As suggested by Mr. Cullen. You want to take responsibility for that?
I defer to you. It was your idea.
All right.
But the problem with that's good. That's a good first step. But the problem is enforcement. Right now, there's no mechanism out there to put the fear of God, so to speak, into, at least in my industry, people stepping over that line and stepping into the practice of law. There's nothing there. We all know the DAs are not going to prosecute this.
Yeah, but
we
you came here something. Opposing this regulation. Now you're saying this, we need more regulations. So what do we do?
We need a regulation, not this particular one. I think this needs to be redrafted.
How would you redraft it?
Well,
I know.
That's really putting me on the spot. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it would take some. I think there's two. First of all, my first blush, there's too many exceptions. Clearly, the exception with respect to drafting the documents, I think it's I. That I just inherently oppose. The gentleman here was talking about that, and I wholeheartedly agree with him. There's forms. I mean, you can go online and get forms at legalforms.com. That's not what this paralegal's doing. They're not acting as a scrivener of forms. They're doing much more than that. They're taking the forms and they're doing all the things that this gentleman here talked about. They're providing the advice. They're making the decisions. They're selecting the forms. That's practicing law.
Yeah, but Mr. Cullen, mm-hmm. That's what your people do all the time. They take that form for title insurance, which is a printed, pre-printed form that your company uses, right? That was drafted probably by a lawyer. Right.
Right.
And a non-lawyer is going to fill that out in your office.
No, well,
or some other title company.
Under the supervision of a lawyer.
Okay, but in another title company, it won't be supervised by a lawyer. So
in
you
our
think
industry,
this should say in the industry, in the title insurance industry, the title insurance policy has to be filled out under the supervision of a lawyer?
Not so much the title insurance commitment and policy itself.
Okay.
I mean, I think
that's a form.
There's a template. I mean, I think that is a better word. I mean, a title insurance policy can be anywhere from a 2-page document to a 25-page document, depending on the complexity and nature of the transaction. So it's far more complicated than saying it's filling out a form. But that's what title insurance companies do. They create commitments and ultimately issue policies. It's the next step, once that commitment is issued, is where the practice of law comes in, and where title companies, I think, overstep the bounds all the time. You want that driveway agreement? Here, we got that driveway agreement.
Okay, but that's drafting something else. Okay.
Right. We need to clear out a particular title issue. We have a particular judgment satisfied in order to clear title on this. Title companies may enter into negotiations with the judgment debtor to resolve that issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's way outside the steps of what title insurance companies should
that
be
was
doing.
Discussed.
And those are the types of things that are occurring. And that's where it goes back to our concept, our business model is that these should be done by lawyers. They are lawyers, and they're fulfilling that role as a title insurance / lawyer, which, by the way, is permitted. I think Justice Prosser mentioned earlier today, how is that permitted? There's a Supreme Court rule, 21.8, which specifically provides for dual services. You can be a CPA attorney. You can be a title agent lawyer. Those are specifically permitted under the dual practice provisions of the Supreme Court rules. Now, the biggest thing that you have to comply with under that is the informed consent law. There has to be an informed conscious consent by the client accepting both services being performed in a particular transaction. So there are provisions in the Supreme Court rules. I think Justice Prosser was asking it in regards of the CPA. If the services are related to each other, for this use the CPA example, and I'm acting as a lawyer representing this individual as a client, as my legal client, and also I am providing CPA services, the fact that I'm now suddenly, I have two hats, and I'm now wearing the CPA hat, the Supreme Court rules are very clear. You do not leave your lawyer responsibility. Your ethical duties carry over to this ancillary practice, this dual practice that you're performing. So you are always under the duties and responsibilities as a lawyer, and you can be brought to OLR for any type of violations in the capacity of that CPA practice when you have that dual capacity going on.
Counsel, earlier in your presentation, you stated, I'm not in favor of this rule. There are too many exceptions. And I looked at, in a cursory fashion, some of the other states. I note the state of Alabama, which does have a uniform, a UPL law, has only one exception, and that deals with title insurers, by the way.
Okay.
Right. That's the only one they have. And
good for Alabama, right?
Alabama, and it, but it specifically prohibits you from preparing certain documents, that is, deeds, conveyances, mortgages, and any paper document or instrument affecting to or relating to secular rights. That's Alabama. Other states, for instance, Arkansas has just one exception, and that's just for insurance adjusters. Another state, the Kentucky, has the only exemptions are someone appearing in small claims court and mediation services. So what should we do with this issue of a rule that has all these exceptions, or how should we be approaching this?
Well, I don't know if I'm really the appropriate person to address that.
Well, I'm looking for I'm looking for a germ of insight, so give me your best shot.
It seems to me that we need a rule needs to be developed. There clearly needs to be a working definition of what is the practice of law. But ultimately, I mean, that's a very tough nut to crack. I mean, you're going to have that. That's going to ultimately end up and result in it being litigated some type of form to resolve the fine print on that. I think if you by putting in lots of exceptions, the exceptions are going to swallow the rule, and we're going to be right back to where we are today, which is really no rule at all. So I guess I don't have a good answer to your question for you.
Well, if you don't have enough specifics and you just have a general rule, then the administrator can use that generality and force people to stop doing whatever they are doing, and the person who is at the other end of the stick doesn't have the wherewithal, the money, to hire counsel or defend themselves against this, and it could be just overwhelming.
This could go both ways.
That's right.
It could go both ways. You're absolutely correct.
And that's why when we when this rule first came to the court, this room was crowded as it was this morning with people who said, hey, this general rule covers me or could be interpreted to cover me, and we got to get out. Otherwise, we're going to be litigating. And what are you going to do? You're going to litigate with 20,000 lawyers, except the ones that are going to defend you. And then that's a very expensive and very time-consuming issue. I mean, it is very troublesome.
I don't disagree with what you're saying, Justice. I really don't. This is a tough nut to crack. That's why this has been hanging around since 2000.
That's why we've had it for so long.
Yeah. I can tell you, just go back to the general premise, I hear it all the time from my attorneys. People who work for our agents, they get very frustrated, it's not a turf thing. It really isn't. It's they feel that, you know, consumers, clients are being provided a disservice,
mm-hmm.
And they're frustrated. So I said my piece.
Thank you. Well, I must tell you that, at least from my perspective, that, and as testified here, there are hundreds of thousands of real estate deals every year. All of them close. All of them have title or might have title issues. All of them might have a whole variety of legal issues, some easily resolved, some not.
I would say, you know, the problem, going back to the harm issue, I mean, there's a lot of title issues out there and a lot of real estate transactions that just have never become ripe. Mm-hmm. Seller's happy, buyer's happy, everyone's happy.
Right.
The problem is still sitting out there.
Yeah.
And you know, those individuals are told, you don't have to worry about that. You know, title company will take care of it.
I used to have clients who would come to me with the offer signed already. Mm-hmm. Then, as a lawyer, you have much less leeway to handle issues that come up because they're covered by the general real estate broker form, approved by the real estate broker board, and this court said that's not practicing law.
Right. Well, I think what the court said in the Dinger decision was, by the way,
it is practicing law, but
right,
okay.
But you have the limited right to practice. As a way of full disclosure, I'm former in-house counsel for the Wisconsin Realtors Association also, so I have the full gamut here.
I'm glad
here.
You
so,
told us that.
Yeah, I sympathize and understand where the realtors are coming. I think the realtors perform an excellent service and an excellent function. What they have carved out in terms of what their rules and responsibilities are under filling out forms is fine. It's good, and there's good regulation involved there. And as Mr. Gunthorpson said this morning, he has no beef with that. They perform a good role. It's that next step. It's that gray area. It's that step between contract and closing, and the services they provide in there is where they start crossing the line at times, even though there's rules in place to not do that.
But the contract itself, even with the Dinger case, is an issue of practicing law.
Absolutely. Drafting a contract, or a realtor can, a broker can draft a deed, they can draft a mortgage, they can draft an offer to purchase, they can draft a listing contract. There's a whole host of documents that they're legally permitted to draft because they have obtained a license, they have attained the necessary knowledge and education to perform that function, and they perform that function well. And the problem being is that there's nothing to contain them within their limited right to practice law.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to appear other than Mr. Hammer and Mr. Zillevy? All right. President Cameron?
Please, the court. I'm speaking as an individual, not as a member or as an official of the state bar. My comments will be mercifully brief, I promise you. A couple of things came up that I wanted to comment on. I started this today by pointing out the infamous billboard from Washera County, and it was suggested by some members of this court that really no harm was being done, and where there is no harm, there's no foul. And I want to tell you what the harm is that's being done and show you conclusively that this violates the public interest. First of all, this paralegal is free to solicit business any way she wants to without restraint. Secondly, she's allowed to commingle her money with her client's money. Thirdly, she's allowed to advise clients to prosecute a certain course of action in which she has a personal interest. Fourthly, she's free to have conflicts between her clients without revealing them to them or without any sanction. Fourthly, she's allowed to take communications that are given to her and repeat them in the grocery store or the hairdresser shop. And finally, she's able to take on a job and prosecute it with a lack of diligence, and the problem is that there's not a thing you can do about it. So that's the problem with our paralegal practicing law. She's not held to the standards the rest of us are held to. Next subject. I'm a private practitioner, and I spend about a third of my time in the last few years straightening out messes that other people have gotten their clients into, generally by the unauthorized practice of law, but not always, of course, and I want to talk to you about just a couple of them. A banker in Partyville knows everything, and a couple came in to see him, Fred and Alice, and they wanted to avoid probate. So he said, fine, what we'll do is we'll put the title to the farm in Fred and Alice and Sally as joint tenants, and that takes care of the problem. Well, they came in to see me a couple of years later. They couldn't refinance the farm. And I said, well, of course you can. Just take Sally with you. Let Sally sign. The three of you sign, and you're done. They can't do that because Sally is only 3 years old. And so they couldn't refinance the farm, and they didn't really understand quite what the problems were. And if you think about that transaction and think about a possible guardianship even, you can see the horror that's involved, not limited to the parents renting the farm from their daughter as they support their daughter. I got into a transaction in which the parties went to the friendly title company. The title people drew up a deed. They accepted all the things called for in the offer to purchase, municipal laws and zoning ordinances and all that stuff. Everyone knew there was a tenant on this property. There was a tenant on this farm. Buyer and seller both knew. Title company knew. And when the dust settled and the transaction closed, the buyer sued the seller for the damage because there was a tenant on the property and prevailed, of course, because the warranty in the deed is absolute and the seller didn't have enough sense to exclude the rights of this tenant. And finally, I got into a deal where CPAs had been in there ahead of me. They'd set up a corporation for three brothers, and two or three LLCs handling some very complicated business deals. And it worked out just fine from a tax perspective. They filled out these tax returns for 35 years or so. But they had no operating agreements, and they had only very cursory bylaws, and they had no buys and sells, and one of the brothers died. And they had a mess that was almost hard to believe. And the CPAs had walked these people right into it. I'm sure they had no idea about this, but that's why they shouldn't be doing these things. Folks, what I'm trying to impress you with is that an option is not to do nothing. Something has got to be done. I realize it's awful trying to define what the practice of law is. It's hard to think about defining it by defining it for what it is not, and that's really maybe what this is before you now. But one way or another, lay practitioners must not be allowed to continue to encroach into the practice of law. They're doing real damage to the public. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Comer. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have a question?
No, I'm sorry.
I think Justice Prosser has a question.
Mr. Comer, I think I asked some questions about the billboard person.
I think so.
You've given me the answers that I was seeking. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Wrap up.
I'll wrap up. I'll try to be as brief as possible. I would like the court, if it would, to permit Jack Zweig, who is the architect of the administrative system, at the end of my comments to make a few brief comments about that system and where it came from. First of all, I'd like to comment that the speaker, Mr. Heil, captured the essence of the problem. And we're going to offer him a position on our committee after this hearing. From the standpoint of the real estate brokers, the realtors, that organization seemed to be concerned that what the state bar is proposing would somehow have a negative impact on the ruling in the Dinger case. That is not the case with respect to the state bar. We have, frankly, no interest in the Dinger case. There is no intention to reverse or go backwards on that ruling. And I hope these comments give the realtors some feeling of solace that we're not trying to cause trouble for them in that area. With respect to the exceptions, there are a lot of exceptions. And we carefully reviewed all of the requests for exceptions, and we tried to accommodate to the extent that we felt we could do that without blowing holes in the proposed rule and its enforcement. We rejected some concepts and accepted others. From the standpoint of there being a lot of exceptions, that's right, there are a lot of exceptions. But we felt from the beginning that you know, we're proposing this rule in the state of the world today. And we have to recognize that things aren't the way they were back in the 1900s or before with respect to the practice of law and the providers of services to the citizens of the state of Wisconsin. And we try to recognize that in the context of the various exceptions. We still believe that that these exceptions are reasonable and that we can have a viable rule defining the practice of law and a system to administer that rule, notwithstanding the existence of the exceptions.
Counsel?
Excuse me.
If we were to define the practice of law essentially as you request, and if we were to accept the exceptions, essentially, perhaps with some modification, but decline to create a new judicial agency or house it at OLR or BBE, but say to the bar, like many other states, you house it. Would you be against this? Would you be withdrawing your petition?
Well, I don't think we would be withdrawing the petition. We probably would be against it, and we would try to convince you that that is not the direction to take. We feel that in order to protect the public from the problems resulting from the unauthorized practice of law, there has to be a rule defining what the practice of law is and some pragmatic way for an administrator to deal with problems that crop up to protect the consumer. The consumers often in this kind of an area are not going to seek remedies of their own. The typical person that becomes involved with the unauthorized practice is not going to be in a position to take action on behalf of himself or herself. We need an administrator to observe what's going on and try to attack the problems before they become really serious with respect to the consumers.
Is having an administrator housed in the state bar a deal breaker?
I can't say on behalf of the state bar whether or not it's a deal breaker. I think the state bar would take the matter under consideration and think about it and try to probably analyze a structure that might work that wouldn't involve the concerns I expressed earlier about having the bar involved. But we at this point prefer that it not go in that direction, and that we have this system housed in the office of OLR or a comparable court agency.
Mr. Zellevy, you're very persuaded that setting it up in the manner that you provided will prove to be fruitful, correct, once
yes.
It's in operation. Would the bar be amenable to our following your lead with some fine-tuning, but putting a three-year sunset on it, not that we'll review it in 3 years, but that it will stop in 3 years unless you show the court that it has been a meritorious process and is worth continuing. And I think I suggested this a little bit by my question earlier in the day about, you know, would the bar be willing to undertake a comprehensive analysis of what happens with this process over, say, 2.5 years, and then perhaps before the three-year anniversary comes up, if you think it needs to continue, then bring a petition to the court to continue it. Otherwise, it would sunset and be gone in 3 years, which, to me, lessens some of the concern of others that this is going to take on a life of its own. First, you're going to have a part-time person, then a full-time, then the full-time needs two staff, then you know how that goes with bureaucracy. We all do. Do you think that the state bar would be amenable to that kind of an adjustment?
I personally think it would give that serious consideration. I think that the bar would look at it as an opportunity to prove to the satisfaction of the court that there really are problems out there that affect the consumers and that this is an effective way to deal with it.
Okay, thank you.
a couple of comments that I want to make that pertain to comments made by some of the speakers. A couple of the interested parties have requested that if their organization, their businesses and professions are regulated by other governmental organizations like those under Chapter 440 to 480, I think it is, that the rules cede authority to deal with anyone that's engaged in the unauthorized practice of law to the other agencies who are overseeing the operations of those particular professions or service providers. And we are unalterably opposed to that. We see no basis for the court ceding any authority to deal with the practice of law to any of the bodies that regulate professions and businesses through the Department of Regulation and Licensing.
Now, you favor 23.083, sub 3, which says the Office of Lawyer Regulation shall cooperate with agencies under 440 to 480, may share confidential information.
Yeah, we have no problem with that. No problem at all.
You don't like the shall. You don't like the word shall in these rules. That it shall, but you have to turn it over. You don't want
no,
to.
No, we don't. It. No, it may cooperate, okay. But not shall. That's correct.
All right.
One of the exceptions that was requested by the insurance industry and which we rejected, I want to comment upon. It's sale of financial products. And I want you to understand, I want the court to understand the frame of reference that the state bar has with respect to that particular issue. Many of the egregious cases that we've observed at the state bar over the years involved the sale of financial products coupled with some incompetent and overreaching estate planning advice. So we tried to accommodate the insurance industry and make sure that its typical way of operating is not disturbed, which we think we've accomplished with the exception that we've agreed to, but that there is no justification for carving out the sellers of financial products. And it probably is a fact that our view of the sellers of financial products is also influenced by the activities of those kinds of businesses in the United States during the past couple of years. We are concerned about it. And it has served as a vehicle for, we think, causing damage to some consumers. Okay, those are the comments that I had, unless there are any questions. And Jack?
Thank you, Mr. Zillevy. Thank you for your time here. Thank you for working on this and for your excellent comments.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Jack Swig. I'm a member of the bar. I'm a member of the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee, and I actually work in a Wisconsin agency that investigates people for practicing professions for which a license is required, and in an agency in which we pursue actions to stop people from doing that. It is the Department of Regulation and Licensing, and I work in the Division of Enforcement. The major part of the work in our Division of Enforcement is pursuing disciplinary actions against people who are licensed. And to that extent, it's similar to what Mr. Celine and the folks over at OLR do. But I started working there 30 years ago. And even 30 years ago, we felt that our statutory authority allowed us to investigate complaints made that people were practicing professions without licenses, which were required. And we would investigate them, put together a nice package, give it to the local district attorney, and for legitimate reasons, the district attorneys would do nothing with them except those few cases in which a child died in childbirth or there was severe harm done to a person because of this conduct. They just weren't interested in spending their time on these cases. So 20 years ago, after I'd been doing this for 10 years, those of us that were doing the work felt that there was a need for a forum for these legitimate complaints to be heard and acted on. There was no public outcry, just like there's no public outcry here, and you shouldn't expect a public outcry, because these aren't folks who the people being exploited, the people being taken advantage of, are not people who come and appear before the legislature or come and appear before this court. But people that do the work, in our case, it was attorneys like myself. In this case, it's people like Tom Zellevy, who for many, many years has been hearing these poor people's complaints and having nothing he could offer to those people. We went to our department and said, we need to get some authority so that we can do something ourselves. And in 1991, the legislature passed 440.21 of the statutes, which gives authority for administrative injunctions. The department secretary has the authority to issue those injunctions to stop people from practicing a profession for which a credential is necessary. Now, our agency, I used to say that we license virtually all professions but attorneys, but that's a little overstatement because I keep hearing other professions, and I find that we don't. But we do license most of the professions, and my career has always been prosecuting healthcare providers. But we also license what we call business professions, such as CPAs, such as realtors, such as surveyors, and such as engineers. We asked for and got this power to do administrative injunctions, and for the last 20 years we've been doing it, and I haven't heard any complaints about the way we were doing it. And believe me, we hear lots of complaints about other things we do.
What do you mean by administrative injunction?
The administrative injunction is that we file a petition, a hearing is scheduled before an administrative law judge, and the administrative law judge issues a proposed decision, and the final decision is made by the department secretary.
And they enjoin a non-licensed person from doing something? Is that your point?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Now, when we do a discipline of a licensee, in most cases it's a professional licensing board that's imposing that discipline, a board made up of members of that profession and a couple of public members. In this case, when we asked for this power, we thought it was important to separate it off so that it couldn't be contended that this was some kind of financial benefit to the profession, and that's why the department secretary issues these and not the licensing board. For example, the CPAs. If we had a complaint that a CPA or that someone was practicing as a CPA, we would seek this injunction, and the injunction would be issued by the department secretary, not by the board. We've had great success with this in most cases. Some time ago, I went back and looked at all the cases that we had done over the past 7 years because of the way data was put into our system. It was the only way that we could measure this. And on an annual basis, the most complaints we received on any single profession was about 21 per year. And I think it was a tie between barbers and cosmetologists and realtors. Now it's interesting that the realtors don't believe there should be any enforcement unauthorized practice of law, but we spend more time enforcing unlicensed practice of real estate than we do almost any other profession. Our system has worked well. We usually start with a letter sent out saying, did you understand that what you're doing is the practice of this profession? And in most cases, people stop right then.
How many people do you have in this division or department?
Do you mean our employees, our divisions? Well, we get 2,000 complaints a year. That's mostly against licensees.
Right.
We have, when we're fully staffed, 12 attorneys, half dozen paralegals, about 20 investigators.
But of the 2,000, only 21 are complaints that someone is practicing a profession that they are not licensed to practice?
No, if I said that, Justice Roggensack, I misspoke. Okay. The most of any one profession was 21.
That's what, I got you.
Yeah.
Do you know how much it would be in a year for all of those similar kind of complaints? Do you have any idea?
I don't have that information with me. I do have it somewhere.
Okay.
And
all
I could obtain that for you.
Okay, thanks.
Would your estimate be close to 200 or 300 out of the 2,000?
I think that would be, we might get 200 complaints. Mm-hmm. But we do an initial screening of complaints when they come in. And I do recall that about 50% of all the complaints we received on licensed practice were screened out without any investigation. So very minimal time spent on them.
Right, and that's true in our OLR, too. What is the cost of these 12 attorneys, 6 you had
paralegals,
and 20 investigators?
I have no idea, Chief Justice. That's not my work.
You just spend the money.
God.
Okay.
Yeah. So we sent out.
You had started walking us through the process of sending out a letter when someone's practicing a profession that needs to be licensed. After the letter, assume they don't stop. What happens next?
Well, the next thing, if they don't stop, then we offer them what we call a stipulated resolution, essentially a consent decree to see if we draft a proposed administrative injunction and an agreement, ask them to sign it, and then present it to the secretary. If they won't sign that, then most of the cases are resolved at that point. But for those people that either don't respond to us at all or contend that what they're doing is not the practice of the profession that we believe it is, then we file a petition seeking the administrative injunction, and that's when we go through the hearing process before the administrative law judge and then the final decision being made by the department secretary.
And then when they don't obey that decision of the ALJ or the secretary, what do? Go to court?
The statute allows at that point for rather severe sanctions in circuit court, something I believe like $5,000 a day, something like that. We have never had anyone in 20 years in which we've had to go to those sanctions. So when we were looking at this, the reason I came on the committee was to help with this piece. And what we've proposed to you is trying to blend the Office of Lawyer Regulation with the same sorts of things as we do in the Department of Regulation and Licensing, and trying to do it in a way that it can all be accomplished through Supreme Court rule, which we thought was the most efficient way to do it when we proposed
not.
This. Excuse me?
I said perhaps, if you're talking about efficiency, if we're in that seventh year.
Yes.
Well, it usually takes that long to get legislation anyway.
So, you know, I still believe this is the best system. You're not trying to create a separate agency where you're going to have all of those additional costs. We're really speculating on how many cases we're going to have in a year.
I tell you what I think is a difference, but it may not be. My bet is on the complaints you get, you're dealing with an individual who may have a business or not, and then steps over a line, and that they're all individuals. What you're dealing with here in this is major industries, banking. You're not dealing with Mr. Z, who's, taking money for a few days from someone. You're dealing with insurance, major industry. You're dealing with realtors, which is a major industry. It's not one realtor who's gone out of line. It's all of them, because they're all doing, or many of them are doing, whatever it is that the bar would object to. Same thing about title insurance. Or the CPA, accountants. You're not dealing with one accountant who's gone astray. You're dealing with an industry who says, hey, we do this every day. Every day. So
when you're talking about regulating or you're talking about sending out a letter, it's not Mr. A or Ms. Z. You're talking about hundreds, maybe thousands of people who have the same interest or substantially the same interest. That's why I think there's a difference in what you, what I hear from you. Now, maybe I'm wrong, so you can correct me.
Chief Justice, I think that you're right. I think that that's a segment of what we're looking at. But I really think the folks that we're aiming this at are more likely to be the individuals. We're not trying to turn the clock back and say only lawyers can do all these things that other professions have been doing for many years. I think that our committee's been very open to saying and putting in the rule that professions can continue to do what they've been doing. You know, what really frightened me was the kind of wide open exceptions that some of these professions wanted, basically to say we should be able to do whatever we think is okay. I mean, that's what's frightening to me. And I really think that isn't what most of the work this entity, whatever it is, will be doing. I think it really will be dealing with more with individual cases. But you could be right on this.
No, I could be wrong on it, but I see it. What I see coming in are industries. What I think that your prosecutions at your level are not industries. Would I don't know. That's my best guess. You know.
Yep, and you are correct. You are correct. They may be businesses, but they're not industries.
That's right. And it may be that particular business, and it won't apply to other businesses that have the same interests. That is, business A may be doing this, but not C through Z.
And I think that's really all I wanted to tell you folks. There'd been an awful lot of talk about the system, and I thought it might be helpful for you to hear from somebody that's actually working in a similar system.
It is, and the department has appeared in other hearings and has offered its cooperation and assistance, and we want to thank you for yours.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for appearing. Is there anyone else who wishes to appear? Hearing and seeing none, as I now close the hearing on 07-09 in the matter of the definition of the practice of law and the administration of a rule defining the practice of law. The court will take a recess and will appear and we'll discuss this rule in open administrative conference. We are in recess until we reappear. So be it.